It's my privilege to introduce Dr. Don DeYoung. Dr. DeYoung is professor and chair of the Science and Mathematics Division at Grace College in Winona Lake, Indiana, where he served for a large number of years now. Dr. DeYoung is also is currently serving as president of the Creation Research Society. Don is the author of a number of books, and he's appeared in a number of videos. And I want to put in a special plug. He brought some of his books with him on the CRS table back there. My wife and I homeschooled our five children, and we used Dr. DeYoung's books really to get science across. I just want to point out the grace and humble spirit of Dr. DeYoung. You would never recognize him as a world-class scientist by his demeanor and spirit. I've never felt inferior or stupid in his presence, even though I actually am. As president of the Creation Research Society, he has a pretty awesome job. He has to get a lot of intellectuals together and actually do something, and that's probably one of the worst audiences to try to capture their attention. But he's done it with, a humble servant's leadership and spirit. So I've really appreciated that about him. If you're interested in great resources, especially for children, please check out some of the books he has there on science and the Bible. So it's my honor to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Don DeYoung.
Well, thank you, Gary, and welcome back, folks. Some of you look a little bit wet. But now think about it. Does it rain on the moon? Or on Mars? Or really anywhere else in the whole universe, as far as we know? That might be kind of a miracle going on out there where we have liquid water coming down, so we need it and let it come, even if it gets us a little bit wet. Well, we're kind of halfway through our day, and we've had lunch, and as we get into this talk, I thought maybe we ought to start with another quiz. You know, we're on a kind of a campus setting here. So I brought a few questions along. These are just basic Bible science questions. See how we can do on them. Number one, in whose day did clocks run backward?
Joshua 10. Joshua 10.
What a question. Now, I know there was Joshua, a long day of Joshua, but that's when clocks stopped. This is when they went actually backward. You got it. Let's see. Is that the book of Hezekiah? No, it's the book of 2 Kings. But it talks about Hezekiah, who was very sick. And as a sign that he would be healed, the shadow went backward on the dial by about 10 steps, it says, whatever kind of mechanism they had. It's estimated it might have backed up about 6 hours. So that would put us back to breakfast time if it was that kind of day here. Scripture says there was never another day like it. We don't know how that happened, whether God stopped the spinning of the earth, got it going backward, maybe he changed the whole universe. It happened. Miracles are beyond explanation. A day when clocks ran backward. Question number two. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? This is one of these psychology type questions here. But there is an answer. Got to have one to the other. How can this be? Let's go with the chicken. Actually, Genesis 1 verse 20 says, let birds fly above the earth. So there they were, and then they started laying eggs. In fact, there's more to that second question. I think it is encouraging the idea of a creation that was fully functional, mature, and ready to go. Didn't have to start with some little protoplasm. God started with birds flying through the air. I like that idea of, I don't know if I want to call it creation with appearance of age, but a fully functioning creation with fully developed chickens. Likewise, by the way, in the astronomy area, I like the idea that when God made those stars, he made them with their light thoroughly spread out. I think Adam and Eve, the very first night they were here, could have looked up and seen the sky much as we see it today. You don't have to wait for that starlight to trickle all the way across space. It was ready to go. Now, there are different views on how starlight gets here, but I like that idea of a mature creation. And that's what we see all around us. Yeah, I got about five questions. We're working through this little warm-up here. Which was the first animal created?
Adam.
Again, looking at Scripture, Adam's not an animal. I won't go with that one. We are not animals. In fact, we care for the animal creatures. This answer, I believe, is actually the largest animal that there ever was. And it's not dinosaurs either. I'm going to go with a whale. Now, this may go back to King James, where you're on the first animal life showing up on day number 5, and it says, God created the great sea creatures. King James says the whales. And I kind of like that idea, that God started with the largest creature that there ever was. Again, not starting with some little speck. It kind of shows us how God can do it. Which Bible chapter describes a dinosaur? Now, how can this be? Didn't they die out 65 million years ago before we were thought of? Didn't they live in a whole land before time? That would be a whole separate conference, of course, on the rocks and the dinosaurs, but I think they do fit in. And you're right, you're looking in the book of Job for this. Actually, there's a couple chapters. Job 40 talks about a creature called Behemoth, and if you read that description, it sounds very much like a land dinosaur. Chapter 41 actually talks about Leviathan. That's not a dinosaur, that's probably a marine reptile, because that thing is in the water. If those are true, those are the only written descriptions we have of these creatures, and that kind of detail, look them over. Apparently Job was familiar with dinosaurs. Did Job live before the flood or after the flood? This is too much to think of this time of day.
Yes.
He's post-flood. He's living in the centuries after the flood. So the dinosaurs were still around, at least a few. They were part of the creation week. Adam named them. They got along with people in the early days. Representatives went on board the ark and came off the ark. Well, I guess they're gone now. Something happened in more recent millennia. Maybe it was a climate change. Maybe people hunted down the last ones. I think we haven't heard the last word on dinosaurs. They lived until relatively recent time. Job knew about them. I guess I just have one more question here. How many animals did Jonah have on the ark? And of course the answer is zero. And if you don't catch that one, I can't help you. But good wake-up Bible science questions. Well, for our time here this afternoon for a little bit, I'm going to call this Discovery of Design. And this is kind of a little different area. It'll touch on some astronomy and some other areas as well. There's a word that's been in the biology realm for ages called mimicry. Mimicry is where one animal kind of resembles another one for protection. For instance, here's an owl butterfly. And it's got this marking on its wing that looks like a big eye, which might keep the birds away. They'll think it's an owl. That's kind of tricky how that was probably established at the beginning, kind of God's plan there for whenever that happened, mimicry. Now, I've added a couple of little prefix on the front there, biomimicry, which is a word that's very popular today. And it would be defined as the discovery and application of designs from nature. Learning things and to solve problems and come up with new inventions and such. Biomimicry, it's called. Now, probably the classic example of this is something you're familiar with, Velcro. You know, it was an Englishman way back 60 years ago who was walking in the woods and noticed that these cockleburrs were sticking to his dog's fur, to his pant leg. And he got home and looked at them closely, and there were little hooks on there. So he went into his own little laboratory and made some artificial Velcro. He didn't invent it. He just discovered it in nature. I'm sure we have Velcro in the room here on our shoes and other places here. It's all over the place. And an idea that came from nature in the first place. Well, this biomimicry is it's really on the front edge today of science. Again, engineers and inventors are looking to nature to come up with new products and to solve technical problems. And so I thought for our time here after lunch, I want to look at 12 examples of biomimicry, things actually that God put in nature. Some of them touch on astronomy, some are more general, but we'll just kind of catch them. These are 12 examples from countless ones that could be considered. Here's the first one. Oh boy, this looks kind of technical here. The electromagnetic spectrum, that's the fancy word for light. I'm going to define light as a wave that travels at that speed C at the bottom of the slide, 186,000 miles per second. We're able to measure that kind of thing. And there's all these different kinds of light. It's called the spectrum. You got radio waves on the far left there, microwaves. I could put in cell phone waves about at that point there, and hi-fi waves. Then we get the visible light. Oh, there's the Roy G. Biv thing. Remember the visible colors? And you get over on the other side as well, the ultraviolet and the X-rays and the gamma rays. Different kinds of light. Well, to narrow in still on this number one example of learning from nature, I've got an arrow pointing toward X-rays. Now, that's one part of the light spectrum. You can't see them, but they travel at that speed C. We get X-rays from space and astronomy. I mean, we get all these different kinds of light coming down from the sky. Of course, light is about all we have from distant stars and galaxies. With our telescopes, we get incredible information from these different kinds of light. Boy, looking at a star's light, you can tell its size, its motion, its chemical composition, its magnetism, its pressure. It goes on and on. This keeps astronomers busy looking at all these different aspects, this message coming down from the sky. Now, these X-rays, we're not exactly sure where they're all coming from space. That's sort of a high-energy atoms that are moving fast that would give off X-rays. Here's a picture of the Sombrero galaxies. I mean, there's 100 billion galaxies that we know of, and so this is one of them. And that's kind of a collection picture there on the left, and it's made up of an X-ray picture. I can see the little insight over on the right-hand side. And then there's some visible light, and there's infrared light. And if you put those three together, you get this kind of detailed picture of this galaxy. You know, ours is the Milky Way. This is when it's Andromeda. And this is all good information. I don't know if this sounds like creation, but to me, all research is creation research. Everything we look at. Now, they may not use the word creation, and they may put the wrong interpretation on it, but it's all studying God's handiwork, His glory, including this galaxy like the Sombrero. These X-rays, they are very hard to collect from space and to focus so that you can see them. I mean, our typical telescope has a mirror, let's say. Well, X-rays go right through the mirror. They don't bounce off and focus together. It's kind of a challenge. How can we really study these X-rays from space? Is there something from nature that can kind of help us along to solve this problem? Well, there is. And so I present to you a lobster. What is this? Lobsters don't see X-rays. But they do have very interesting optics that we've studied and learned from. Lobsters do not have a cornea and a lens like we have. Their eyes are quite different. It's the way they've been created. Now, there's a little bit of detail here. There's a lobster at the bottom with an arrow pointing toward his eye. And the upper picture shows that their eye is actually filled with countless little rectangular open boxes. And the inside of these boxes is silvered like a mirror. And so light enters these little enclosures and kind of ricochets off the side. If you look at my red arrow down there in the lower right, and finally gets to where the sensor is so that the lobster can see. Instead of a lens, it uses this bouncing off a mirror. By the way, I was bringing some show and tell things along today. I was trying to think what this would look like, so I took four small mirrors and just kind of taped them together like this. Now, this would be about 1,000 times larger than the one in the lobster. And he's got hundreds of these as you look at that top picture. But this is what their eye looks like. The light goes through, ricocheting off the side, and then it gets into where their retina is. Let me just pass this around so you can take a look at it. It's just a cheap mirror that I put together. But to think about what a lobster's like. Well, it turns out, as this has been studied, that this is a solution to measuring X-rays. When X-rays hit a mirror at a grazing angle, a small angle, then they don't go through it, but they bounce off. It's almost like rocks skipping off a puddle. So what have we come up with? They call it the Lobster Eye X-ray Telescope. This is supposed to be put in orbit next year. It's actually a group of European countries that have put this thing together. And they say that they were inspired to come up with this kind of design by studying the optics of the lobster. Anyway, there's a picture over on the right kind of showing what it's like. They got these rectangular boxes, and they've silvered the inside, and this has a pretty wide span of the sky. So it looks like this is going to be up there on the space station and operating a lobster eye telescope. Ideas from nature. By the way, we already have X-ray telescopes that are operating, and this is one that's been around for over a decade. It's called Chandra. And instead of boxes, this one has these circular mirrors, and the X-rays scoot through as well, and then they get focused together. One area of space to explore X-rays and getting ideas on how to better do that by studying something underwater, lobsters that God put there long ago. Hey, we got 12 examples we're going to look at, and that's the first one. Let me move on to the next one. Well, it's July and August. Do you get lightning bugs in your yard? What a pleasure those things are to look at as they kind of flit around. So I was thinking about fireflies. And, I had that spectrum a minute ago of the different kinds of light. Well, this is interesting light. How do those things do that? They don't have batteries, do they? By the way, speaking of light, there's something very basic about that. You know, day one, and God said, let there be light, and there it was. And on day one, that wasn't the sun. It doesn't come along until day four. We don't know what that original light was, but God made it. And we've got these different kinds of lights as well. So now we've got firefly lights. Well, these things have been studied somewhat to see how they do this. They call it a chemical light. And it turns out that these little critters, they can make two chemicals from the food that they eat, which is smaller bugs. And they keep these two chemicals separate in their body, and when they put them together, it makes this light come on. In fact, they have names for these two chemicals. They call them luciferin and luciferase. Well, we've been able to come up with that in the laboratory and make those now, and we've come up with these devices that you can get at the store, these things called light sticks, where there's a chemical, two of them in here, and they're separated with a little glass vial, and you kind of have to break it. You've seen these, the kids all like these kind of things to make them turn on. In fact, with that storm going on, maybe the lights will go out around here, so let me get these things activated. We got a couple of fellas here. Can you guys get these going for us? Have you messed with these before? Here's one for each of you. You could just kind of bend them and shake them and just kind of hold them up so we can see them. Light sticks. Can you make them work? Bend them hard so that cracks. I don't know, are they kind of working? Well, a little bit anyway. These things are very useful, you know, for backpacking or fishing. And they make some really bright ones now so that if you have car trouble, they replace flares. Don't look all so bright, but that's examples of it. Very useful devices. And where do we come up with this idea? By studying fireflies. Another example from nature. We haven't quite caught on to doing it like the fireflies. They can do it for a couple of weeks. Those things quit after a couple of hours, so we're still kind of working on it on that area. As this whole talk goes along, my position, my thought is that God has put countless ideas in nature for us to find and come up with practical solutions to problems. We haven't found most of them yet, but it's kind of exciting to look at it this way. It's a design that's all around us, just waiting to be found. In fact, I was thinking about those light sticks. Okay, we've studied those things and came up with a chemical, how they work. I've just used my imagination. You know, there's angels around us watching us. And so they look at those light sticks and they say, well, they finally figured that out, why God made lightning bugs, so that we can come up with these neat little devices. I don't know, but I'm just thinking here. We got 12 examples, so we're up to number 3 already. Now I'm back to this electromagnetic spectrum, and this time I'm looking at this little stuff here, this part called infrared. Now you can't see that, but the sun gives off infrared radiation as well, and actually you can feel it, it's heat. And that comes from the sky, and so we have infrared telescopes. They're not all that accurate, they're not that precise, but we get all the information we can from the sky. Is there something we can learn from nature on how to precisely measure infrared radiation? Well, there is, and we're studying these kind of things, and it involves bugs. Boy, we've had quite a month out there in the West with the tragedy and the forest fires, but this kind of connects with it. These brave guys and gals that hike in to fight a forest fire, you know, just dusty, dangerous work, they've noticed that when they're hiking into a remote area to work on this fire, there will be beetles flying in the same direction. In fact, they'll pass them, headed for the fire. Wouldn't everything be going away from the fire? But these fire beetles, as they call them, or melanophila, if you want to see the technical name there, these beetles, they're programmed so that they go to where there's been a fresh fire, and they lay their eggs on charred wood. Wood that's still hot. And that's just what they do. That's, you know, that's their business. And they've studied these beetles and how they can go toward a fire. And they've made, you know, measurements and decided that these bugs can detect a forest fire from a distance of 80 miles. Now, firefighters are using satellites and airplanes to do this. But these things somehow can pick up this infrared radiation from a fire at these huge distances. And so they've decided that these crazy little bugs have some sort of sophisticated electronics in their body that can detect infrared. That's heat that's coming from a fire. And so they're studying these beetles to see if they can copy that to come up with new kinds of detectors, even in the astronomy world, to use in space. Not only are we using lobsters for new kinds of telescopes, but we're using these fire beetles. Now, we're not there yet. We don't quite understand how they can tell fire from that kind of distance, but they do, and that's part of the whole story as well. Ideas from space. Our example number four, this is the small scale. Now, these are little things called diatoms. Some are plants, some are animals, some are kind of in between. They're like as small as a grain of sand, and these things are everywhere. They're in the grass. They're out there floating in Lake Michigan. They're in the sand, the soil, and they build glass houses. These little things have this silicon that they have on their exoskeleton here, and if you take these electron microscope pictures, they look like this. I mean, they're all over the planet, and they're very intricate. I look at pictures like this, and I think, aren't there treasures of design on the small scale, things that we hardly ever see? Some of these little diatoms are shaped like a star. And there's a whole bunch of them on the right-hand side of this picture. In the old days, these microscope people used to have contests to see how many diatoms they could mount on one glass slide. You don't want to sneeze when you're doing this. But they have these neat pictures that are works of art as they collect these diatoms. Well, can these things play a part in design and practical uses, things that God set up for us? I guess so. Some of these diatoms, they look like a sieve. These are tiny little openings. Other ones look like a gear. Now, they're quite fragile, but you can take these diatoms and you can coat them with metal. We call it sputtering, and it'll make them more permanent. You can turn them into metal. This brings up a topic called nanotechnology. You've heard that word? Now, this is complicated things on a small scale, even smaller than the micro world. This is nano. And on that level, they are building things like pumps, and motors and valves that are so small they float through the air. I mean, there's medical uses to take into your body, and there's also uses for this in space. If you think about this, I was looking up what it costs to put an object into space orbiting around the Earth, and it's over $1,000 a pound. You know, we're putting a lot of things into orbit. So would you like to orbit the Earth? Take your weight, multiply by 1,000, and that'd be the approximately how much it would cost. It's expensive business, this space stuff, because things are heavy. Well, the thought is maybe the new generation of space probes will be very small, made out of this kind of nano-type stuff, so that it, you know, you don't have all this weight you're putting up in space, but on a smaller level. Nanotechnology, kind of one of the future trends in really efficiency of space exploration. I can't quite imagine those things that are so small you can hardly see them. Complicated devices and detectors and spectrometers. But that's what they're making. Related to that, here's another one. Have you heard this word, buckyball? I know they make those little strong magnets. They call them that as well. But this is a little bit different. This is a new form of carbon that was found back in the 1960s. Here, I brought a copy of it along here. There are 60 carbon atoms. That's the black things on here. And they all kind of attach to each other in this chemical bonding, and they make like a soccer ball. Now, these things are really small. I mean, many thousands of them would stretch across just a period in a sentence. But these things are quite common. Even when you have a candle burning in the black soot, it's making these little buckyball things. And so they're all around. Here, the screen shows several different types of pure carbon, and buckyball has made the list as well. These things are coming down from the sky. They're in space, and they're on the Earth as well. And I like these little things here, and I'm wondering what I'm looking at purpose in nature and what these could be used for, and there are possibilities. Back to nanotechnology. Could it be that we could build things so small that these little guys could be ball bearings in small motors? That's the kind of thing they're looking at. And these could also be containers to hold just a little bit of medicine that you can take in your body and then have some sort of a time release of some sort. Nanotechnology using these devices, and I'm who knows where that'll all go, but interesting examples from nature of things that are useful to us. Anyway, that's the small scale. We got to go on here. We got 12 of these to look at. Now we got a lander on Mars here called Spirit. This has been up there for a while. We keep sending things to Mars, you know, and they're drilling holes in rocks and they're looking for liquid water and making chemical analysis. What are they actually looking for? Martians, right? They're looking for life. And so far they haven't found any. You know, all I can say is after 60 years of this whole space age, there's not a shred of evidence of life anywhere else but on Earth. this place looks pretty special, and on Earth it's everywhere from pole to pole, and Mars looks like a pretty dead and sterile place. In fact, if they ever do find any little microbes up there, they probably came from the Earth. We've sent so many probes up there, I expect we probably contaminated the place by now. Well, now, Spirit was one of the probes that was up there, and it kind of was rolling around on these wheels and making different kinds of analysis, and along about 2010, it got stuck in the sand. You know, there's nobody there. This is remote. And so they rocked this thing back and forth as time would permit. For 10 months, they tried to get it loose. And they finally gave up. It's still sitting there in the sand. I don't think this thing functions anymore. It gave us some good use. It took a lot of pictures, but it's just there. It got stuck in the sand. And there it shall be for all time, I guess. And it makes a person wonder, this whole idea of space exploration, maybe wheels are not the kind of thing to use because they get stuck. In nature, when it comes to critters, you don't really see wheels. Instead, you know, you see legs. And so this opens up this whole area of robotics where instead of using wheels, you use kind of like artificial legs that can move around. Oh, the kids have all these toys now. They have all these little deals that can move around and they're kind of fun. And anyway, NASA, our government, our space exploration area, has taken this very seriously. And so the next generation of space probes, instead of wheels, they're thinking of using legs. And so they're building these big spiders. You say, I don't like spiders. Well, but they can be useful. You can see the guys around the one in the lower picture. These are quite sizable. And so this is the kind of thing that they can send into space, and it won't get stuck, and it can climb over rocks. In fact, if the whole thing gets tipped over, they can just move the legs around the other way, and it can keep on walking along. There's some advantages to this kind of device, a giant-sized spider there. Anyway, the future of robotics using the example of insects and bugs that we study to come up with new ways to solve problems. Hey, we're looking at some discovery of design in nature. And let me just break in here for a minute. I think that there is some scripture encouragement with this. Now, here's a verse from the book of Job. Ask the animals and birds, and they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it will teach you. The hand of the Lord has done this. It's sort of a challenge to study nature, to see God's hand and his planning and his purpose. From that verse, I tell you what I get. That tells me that if you're studying science or learning a language or some kind of skill or hobby or whatever, if you ask the Lord for help and you honor him, he'll give you some good results. And that's the challenge for us, even with this talk, to study nature, giving God the credit for the things that we find. And then there are all kinds of useful devices that we can find in nature. Just kind of an encouraging verse for us. And by the way, again, this whole talk is kind of connected with something else. Here, I was putting a whole bunch of words in this picture. All parts of what's called the creation worldview. You know, worldview, it's your set of beliefs. And there's several things there. They're all parts of the story that we're telling this week. And I put an arrow on this area called intelligent design. And that's kind of, again, what this talk is into, the design of those fire beetles and the lightning bugs and everything else. Now, you don't want it to just stand by itself because it doesn't talk about the designer. It just says there's incredible design. But if you get this whole part of the picture, there definitely then is a place for intelligent design. It's part of the whole story. So again, that's kind of connected with what we're doing here in this particular session. In fact, let me show you another example of intelligent design. Again, this kind of gets away from it is a discovery. And this will get a little bit technical, but if you're interested in this. I was talking about the sun and the spectrum and the light. And this picture, I see three graphs. They kind of look like mountains there. Anything that's warm gives off radiation, those different kinds of light. And the lower picture there, that bottom mountain, it says 1,000 kelvins. That's a different temperature scale. And if that's all the heat that you have, I can see this is the range of radiation it gives off. You see that lower hill there? There's some visible light, some infrared light. That middle-sized mountain, that one in the middle that I've kind of pointed out with that big arrow, that's if an object is about 5,500 kelvins. There's its energy spectrum. And if something gets really hot, like 30,000 kelvins, then it's that upper mountain, the one on top. Well, our sun, the surface of the sun, kind of gives off that middle picture. That's the solar spectrum. And there's quite a range there, all the way from X-rays to radio waves. But I kind of broaden out that ribbon in the middle. There again is the visible colors. And I kind of have the Roy G. Biv backward there, starting with the red on the right. But those are the visible colors. And if you notice how that overlaps the spectrum for the sun, this is the majority of the sun's light. It's right in the visible range. The sun does give off some X-rays and gamma rays, but its most intense area is visible light. Well, thank you, Lord, for that, because we like rainbows and things like that. Interesting that the sun is special. It has a surface temperature that specializes in the visible light that we can see. There's more to the story. This light, when it comes from the sun, as it heads toward the earth, a lot of it doesn't make it. It gets absorbed by the atmosphere. And they call this the visual window. This is the part of the light that gets through to the ground. X-rays don't make it. They get caught in the upper atmosphere. And those longer wavelength, the infrared and the radio, they have trouble getting through as well. The way that our atmosphere is set up, it just lets through the visible light. Well, that's kind of interesting. There's more to the story. It turns out that our eyes, we don't see X-rays, and we don't see ultraviolet light. Our eyes are tuned to see visible light. There's a lot going on in this picture. Maybe I'll lose you right after lunch. And someone will say, well, what's the big deal here? Our eyes evolve for the kind of light that's available. But look, there's a three-way correspondence here. This is most of the light that the sun gives off, and that's the light that comes through, and this is what our eyes are sensitive to. This is either a great coincidence or it's planning by the Creator the way He's set it all up. This is interesting, intelligent design, the way it's been all set up, so we can see the colors, so we can look all around us and enjoy this beauty that God has put in nature. We got 12 examples to look at, and we're approaching the halfway point, so we got to keep on sailing here. A beech leaf. Now, some of us have beech trees in our yard. They grow all around the Midwest here. This is an interesting type of tree. In the spring, you know, when the new leaves form, the whole leaf grows, and it's all folded up inside a pod. And then on one day, the pod splits, and the whole leaf suddenly shows up. It just unfolds, and there it is. And I can see the little side veins here, this leaf, the way that it's kind of like an accordion. In fact, I was trying to make a little example here, so let me try this. This is a big economy-sized beech leaf. Here it is all kind of folded up in its pod, and then one day it splits, and the whole leaf shows up, just like that. And it's kind of interesting folding mechanism, and there it goes. In fact, some butterflies unfold their wings as well, this whole area of folding in nature. We do that again here. It's all folded up, and then wham, there it goes, a giant-sized beech leaf here. Well, we're looking for ideas from nature, trying to, you know, make a buck on this and come up with solutions to problems. And so maybe there's something about this folding mechanism that we can use. In fact, maybe we can do something with the space program. When we put up orbiters, satellites circling the Earth, they'll have to have a solar panel of some sort to collect some sunlight. But to get them up there, they've got to be all folded up if they're going to be in a rocket. And then when they get up there, they unfold. And so this idea of the way the beech leaf works has been used with more than one spacecraft. And here's the one example I found. It's called the Japanese Space Flyer. And that was way back in the 90s. And they used the kind of the folding mechanism that the beech leaf had to spread out those long panels after it got up there. And I'm not sure that picture, that little inset in the lower right, is from that spacecraft or from a different one, but I can see that accordion, that zigzag pattern. Of all things, using a leaf from a tree as a way to improve technology for the space program. This is amazing, this discovery of design in nature. And by the way, this whole area of folding mechanisms, what do they call that? Origami, folding paper and such, that's being used all over the place. And even away from the space program, they've studied the leaves of butterflies, and they've come up with a way that they can unfold. I think this is made out of bamboo. They call these shelters that can be put up in a place where they're, you know, they need to have shelter for someone. If there's been an earthquake or whatever. Anyway, you can Google this kind of thing and see how people are studying every kind of folding there is in nature to come up with new ways that we can even improve the lives of people and spacecraft. I'm going to go on here. We're sailing through these different ideas from space. And since I'm from Indiana, I had to mention corn. You know, there's something interesting about this corn that we've learned from it. Now, the picture on the right here shows a small corn shoot. It looks like someone pulled it right out of the ground. What's been noticed is that on a sunny day, sunlight hits the top of the corn where the leaves are, and it goes right down through the stem and goes underground. And if you could somehow dig the soil out of the way, it's lit up underground. These plants conduct light down there. That's how they get energy, along with the water and the nutrients in the ground. They're using solar energy to grow. Now, some other plants do this besides corn as well, but I like corn as our example. Conducting light from one area to another. And there's the name that goes with this called fiber optics. That's kind of a name for our day. In fact, I noticed they're laying fiber optics cables all over our land. These are replacing metal cables. Maybe some of your email goes through fiber optics if it's not wireless. Fiber optics, kind of the modern way to send information. And here, I brought some fiber optics along. It's interesting stuff here. This kind of looks like fishing line or something. But anyway, let's try a little experiment together. Gordon, maybe you can help us here. Let me just stay seated there, but let me give you the end of this if I can find it. Could you just hold this? Okay. And it's quite a length there. What I was going to do is shine a light in this end and see if we can get it to come out that end, because that's how fiber optics works. Okay, oh great, we got a knot in there. But let's just leave it and see what happens. Now, if this was a garden hose in your backyard, could you shine a flashlight in one end and get the light to come out the other end? Try it, it won't work. But this is fiber optics, this is a little bit different. Now for our light source here, I have this laser beam. This is one of these green ones. Well, these are kind of interesting. So we'll have to watch. Gordon, can you kind of hold that up in the air so we can see it? And I'm going to shine this in this end, see if we can get the light to come out that end. Yes. They're clapping for you, Gordon. Way to go. Doesn't take much to please us, does it, in the afternoon? Yeah. Thank you, Gordon. If this stuff was stretched clear across the campus, this would work. If it's good fiber optics, clear across Wisconsin. If this stuff is working like it's supposed to, it's total internal reflection, 100% of the light goes through. Now, when it comes to email, it's an invisible kind. They'll probably use infrared, but so the whole thing works. Fiber optics. So they're trying to improve this stuff, and make this. And one thing that they're studying is corn. Because that's God's fiber optics, and it's been around since the plants were made way back there on day 3. Something else to learn from nature. I thought we better keep you guys thinking here. Again, it's kind of sleepy this time of day. So we got all these designs from nature. So I just came up with a quick ones here. This is not part of our 12. This is extra credit. Can you take a minute and do the matching? These are plants, it looks like, over on the left-hand side, and then uses over on the right. And you have to, connect them with arrows. Look at them for a minute, see if you can compare with your neighbor, and then we'll reveal the answers. One down and 4 to go. Most of our useful medicines have come from the plant world. This is this great reservoir of useful things that God's given us, and most of them we haven't found yet. I mean, that's a reason to preserve plants and study them. There's just a lot of good stuff there. I mean, beneficial plants and medicines and drugs. So anyway, there's aloe vera. Some of you have that at home, and that liquid from that, it's used in sunscreen and all those kind of things. Ginkgo, what's that for? Oh yes, memory, that's what it is. I've never tried this, I don't know, but the health food stores, they sell ginkgo biloba. It's supposed to help memory, and maybe we could use some of that. Lavender. Now that's an herb. I was looking at recent technical articles where they're studying the chemicals that they derive from these plants and what they can be used for. And somehow the chemical or the fragrance or whatever is good for stress. So that might be good to have some of that around. This gets easier, right, as we go along. Peppermint. Yeah, we don't have many left here. It's digestion. You know, Pepto-Bismol kind of tastes like peppermint. There's something about that that can settle the stomach. So there's that one. Oh, this thing ends all of a sudden here. Sugar beets. That's a big product up here in the Midwest, you know. We don't have sugar cane, but they have sugar beets. They noticed actually it was across the lake over there in Michigan, these big companies, they squeeze these beets and they get the sugar out of them. And then they had this leftover liquid, and they put it in a holding pond, and in the hard winter, the pond didn't freeze. And they got to looking at the pond, what is that kind of residue liquid in sugar beets? Well, it's a natural antifreeze. And so what they're doing, and I noticed they're doing it up in these parts of Wisconsin now in the wintertime for the roads, instead of salt, which can kind of tear up the vegetation, they're putting sugar beet juice on the roads. It's biodegradable, it dissolves and goes away after a while, but it will not freeze, and it can work on the highways. Actually, they do a mixture of different things here, but they're using this. It just sat around for a long time in holding ponds and suddenly realized it's useful. If you catch the drift, there are hundreds, no, there are thousands of examples like this. And they're all kind of interesting. I think these can even be used as kind of object lessons, open doors to challenge people, what's all around us, these things that they're all useful. They're all part of God's plans, and it goes on and on. And we got to go on here. So here's the next one. Oh, I'm back to that same picture again. I got a lot of mileage out of that. Now, this time I'm way over on the right-hand side, gamma rays. We get some of those from space, and there are gamma ray telescopes. That's really high energy stuff, but you've got to be careful of gamma rays. They're dangerous. That's the highest energy, very penetrating. And this is a concern for the space program. The plan is, within the next 2 decades, to send somebody to Mars. Any volunteers? The younger ones say yeah. The thought is it'll take about a half a year to get there. Then you'll want to, you know, mess around for a while and come back again. But the hazard is, if you're going to be in space for 6 months going to Mars, you're going to be exposed to radiation. Now, on Earth here, we're protected by the Earth's magnetic field. That kind of shunts things away so that it doesn't hit us. But if you're in the middle of space, there are gamma rays out there, and they could do you some harm. Well, now, we have people up in space now in the space station, and they have an inner place where they can go if there's a surge of gamma rays to protect yourself. On Earth, we mainly shield gamma rays by using lead or lots of water. That can stop gamma rays. But lead and water, those are both heavy. You can hardly send a bunch of that into space if someone's going to Mars. How can we protect people? Now, I don't know if you think we should go to Mars or not, but it's all part of exploring, I think, creation. Is there something, some kind of hint that we can get from nature that can solve this problem of the danger of gamma rays? Well, I guess there is, since I brought up this particular topic on this number 8. And this will kind of go back in time here. This will sound like it doesn't connect too well. Oh, Chernobyl, 1986. That was a bad news story. Nuclear reactor there caught on fire. Apparently, they didn't take that good care of things. And made a real mess, killed people. The mess is still there. They're still cleaning this thing up almost 3 decades later. Chernobyl. That's one reason why we, in this country, we're not too big on nuclear stuff. I know we had Three Mile Island, but this was a much more serious one. Anyway, in just the last 5 years, of course, we're helping them here to clean it up, you know, good old Americans over there doing what we can. What they've noticed, just in the last 5 years, there are things growing around this disaster, this ruin, this wreck, a kind of a fungus, and it's black stuff. And it has the fancy name, let me just call it Cryptococcus. And they've been studying how can this stuff grow when everything else been driven out of there is still danger, high level of radioactivity, but this fungus seems to be thriving. Here's what they say. This fungus seems to know how to protect itself. It makes tiny spheres, nanometer in size, of a pigment, and has just the right size to bend, scatter, and eventually absorb gamma radiation. It changes gamma radiation into useful chemical energy. This stuff is eating gamma rays. Now on Earth, all we know is we got to stay away from gamma rays. It's very dangerous, very high energy, and these things are working with it. So the thought is, if we can study this kind of fungus, and figure out how it's making these little circles, these little nanospheres, which somehow absorb gamma rays, maybe we can come up with something similar to coat the outside of a spacecraft to protect the guys and gals going into space. This is crazy, this stuff. Now, I don't think you want to use this fungus. It's dangerous. But the mechanism that it's using to actually eat and make use of gamma rays, this has got people really interested. And so instead of a fear, maybe we can get some value out of gamma rays after all. Anyway, I'm showing you 12 examples from nature, and these are all still being developed and worked on. The next one. Are we up to number 9? Look at this silly bird here. You heard of a kingfisher before? They're around here in Wisconsin. They're down in Indiana. They're all over the place. This bird looks like it's designed by a committee. I mean, it's got this little body, but a great big oversized head and quite a large beak. And what this thing does is it sits up on a tree limb, and when a fish or a frog goes by, down into the water it goes to get its lunch. And when it goes into the water, it doesn't make any splash. It just slips right in. This ought to be in the Olympics, you know, with a high dive with very little splash, and in they go. It's an interesting thing how this thing operates. Well, now this story goes on. Could I just take our minds a minute to Japan? That country has high-speed trains. They call them bullet trains. We don't have anything quite like that in the U.S. yet. We may eventually. These are trains that go 200 miles an hour, and they're very safe. They've got them around there. Now, Japan also has lots of mountains, and these trains are going so fast you can't go over the mountains, so they have tunnels through the hills. They've noticed that when a high-speed train goes through a tunnel, a cushion of air builds up in front of the train, and when it exits the tunnel, this air rapidly expands and makes a sonic boom. It sounds like thunder. It wakes people up. It rattles the windows for miles around. It's not a good thing. And Japan has very high standards on sound pollution. And so they thought something needs to be done about these trains. They're just, tearing up the place. One of the designers of these trains was also into bird watching and came to mind the kingfisher and how this thing can slip from air into water in an analogous way. It's like a train going from in a tunnel to the open air. And so we thought, maybe there's something about the way this thing is designed that would be useful to us. So they've gone to work on these bullet trains and redesigned them to kind of mimic the kingfisher. And so here's what these trains look like now with a real long tapered front end. I got quite a kick out of this picture. If you look at the little the squares on that train there, they even mimic the nostrils of the bird for the lights on this thing. And they have found out now that these kind of trains with this kind of design, they don't make any sound when they leave the tunnel. In fact, just going across the landscape, they're so streamlined, they save about 20% of energy. Learning how to design trains by studying birds that God made way back during the creation week, it's interesting stuff. I can see where inventors and designers are looking at nature to learn. Now, they don't use the word creation often, but that's exactly what they're doing as they work on this kind of thing. Hey, we're moving along with these examples. You better keep moving along here. I'm up to number 10. Oh, this looks like math. I just had this picture of all kinds of math symbols here. And, you know, we all have different interests. Some are into math and some are into the arts. And it's great the way God's made us each with our own interests and gifts and abilities. But there's something about math that's kind of curious. There's still lots going on in math. I mean, there's a large math department here on this campus. And there's research going on, people writing books and coming up with new theses. People are still inventing new functions in mathematics. Whole new areas of math are being put together. Over and over again, these new fields of math that are developed, they're very elegant and fancy to look at, but people will say, well, what's that good for? And then years later, they'll find out that that particular type of math exactly fits something that's in nature. This just keeps happening over and over again. You come up with a math, and then later on you find out, yes, it fits. And I think this is, once again, an example of design. And I think math is, even if we don't care for it, it's the language of creation, and it's all around us. Let me just mention a few examples here. And we don't need all these details in this picture. Ellipses. You know, that's the name for this kind of a squashed-down circle. Kind of looks like a doorknob. Ellipses were studied way back in B.C. times by the Greeks, you know, 2,000 years ago. And there they sat. It was interesting math. Well, 1,600 years later, Johann Kepler was trying to figure out what orbits are like. Mars going around the sun, the Earth going around the sun, and they were collecting this data. They thought, is it a perfect circle when these planets orbit? It didn't fit the math. Is it an oval? That didn't fit the math either. Finally, they realized that planets move on a perfect ellipse. And so this math was all in place to understand orbits. It's the same with the moon going around the Earth. It's an ellipse. All orbits are like this. Now, it has to do with gravity, but the math was all in place long before it was needed. It was before its time. I got a couple more examples from the math world in case you're interested. There's a fellow by the name of Clerk Maxwell. And he's a physicist from 150 years ago and came up with the famous Maxwell equations. Now, these are very sophisticated. These are differential equations. They explain wave phenomena. They explain light, all that electromagnetic stuff. He did that back in the 1860s. In fact, those equations predicted that there should be such a thing as radio waves before they were even known about. Well, it was about 20-some years later then that Henry Hertz discovered radio waves because they had been predicted by these equations in the first place. Somebody has said that mathematics is often 100 years before its time. It comes up with the math and how it works. Then later on, we find it in nature. I think it's all part of God's planning. I got a couple more examples of this. There's a whole field of math called matrices, which is sort of a way to arrange numbers, and then you can manipulate those and solve all kinds of problems. They were developed back in the 1850s by several people, and there they sat. Who wants that kind of math? Matrices? That's just something, to put in the classroom. Well, it was during World War II. When an engineer, I have her name there at the bottom, Olga Todd, used these matrices to analyze the vibration of aircraft during World War II. It was the only way to solve this and come up with a solution to the problem. There's a quote from her, "I didn't look for matrix theory, it found me." Apparently she had learned it in class and then realized it was exactly the very thing that she needed. Again, where math leads the way, these patterns, this design, this intricacy that we have in nature to understand all the details of creation. I think I had one more here as well. Oh yes, Boolean algebra. Some of you had to study that in school. Now that's interesting stuff. In fact, this is way back in the 1800s. In fact, there's two people. One's name is George Boole, and the other one's name is August De Morgan. And those guys, way back then, they kind of came up with this thing called binary arithmetic and Boolean algebra. Complicated stuff. And somebody looked at it and said, well, that's interesting, but it's not good for anything. So there it sat, Boolean algebra. And so then what finally happened during our lifetime? This is when solid state electronics has taken off, digital electronics. And Boolean algebra is exactly what's needed. It's what makes computers work and cell phones and everything else. And there it sat for like 100 years. And then it was realized, yep, that's what we want to have. At the bottom of this slide here, I have a quote. This is Wigner, one of these Nobel Prize winners. He wrote this classic essay. You could Google this. It's all over the place. It's not that long an article. And there was his title, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. He says, why is it that this thing all fits ahead of time? I think there's design going on here. I think it's all God's fingerprint. And that's what that article is all about. Hey, we're nearing the end of this. I think we got just a couple more to go here. Yep, I'm up to number 11 already. Oh, I thought I'd go way back in time here. Oh, back to the dinosaurs. Now, here's Ankylosaur, about as large as a school bus. They had their time, didn't they, these interesting creatures? And this one is, its unique feature is that tail that it has with that big knobby protrusion. Looks like a big hammer. I don't know, I guess you'd stay out of his way. Whether that was protection or knocking down trees for food or whatever, there it is. Now, even though these things are gone, and they're fossilized, they're turned to stone, and we can look at their footprints, and we can find the prints even of that bony protrusion on the end of the tail, and study when they're fossilized what it was like inside, and it turns out that those weren't big, heavy clubs like solid bone or something. They were, well, let me just try this picture here. I was working with some little kids, and we hauled out the Play-Doh. And we were making these kind of like sausages, and when we were piling them up like this is what it looks like inside the ankylosaur's tailbone. It's these different tendons that it had, and they were crisscrossed one way or the other, and with some open spaces here. And this made that tail end very strong, but lightweight. And so that's kind of what it looked like. And what this was reminding me of is the way fiberglass is made, or actually any kind of composite structures where you're putting different materials together for strength. Now, I don't think that we discovered fiberglass by looking at the ankylosaur. This is more recent, how they've seen that this tail works. But it was there all the time, this crisscross structure, which leads to great strength. Now, this is an interesting point, this ankylosaur. This whole talk that we're working on here, it's typically said that if you're looking at a lightning bug or a firefly or whatever, you know, these things have slowly evolved. They have fine-tuned themselves over millions of years. And the ones that didn't have these kind of apparent designs, they died out. But look at the ankylosaur. This is an old thing, and it's got the design there from the beginning. These things didn't evolve and get fine-tuned. Some of the fossils show us the best designs of all. Not that they're all that old. They've been around since the creation week, but they're just there. So, so much for these creatures. Even dinosaurs have things to teach us. We're up to number 12, so we're going to make it here. Back to astronomy. There's interesting stars in space. There's red giants, there's white dwarfs, and then there's this thing called a pulsar, also called a neutron star. These are stars that have collapsed, kind of like old age. And as they've collapsed, they've kind of spun up to a higher value of rotation. Just like a skater, if they pull their arms in, you know, they'll rotate faster. That's what these things do. And so these are small, compact stars spinning very rapidly, and their magnetic field as well is kind of shrunk up and concentrated. And as a result of all that, they're giving off a beam of radio waves. That's the blue things here in two opposite directions. And as these things spin, this beam just kind of moves around through space. And the only time you could see it is if this thing happens to cross the Earth. And some of them do that. But these things are like lighthouses in space. In fact, when they were first seen, it was thought maybe they're aliens trying to contact us. But now we know of hundreds of pulsars, even in our own Milky Way. So these things are being looked at. Some of these pulsars really turn rapidly. Some of them turn at 100 times per second. A star spinning that fast. What is even the Earth, 24 hours for one spin? Some of these pulsars turn at 500 times per second. In fact, some pulsars turn at over 1,000 revolutions per second. A star, miles in size, and going, how can that even hold together? You'd think it would disintegrate, but they do. They must have very strong gravity. So this is just an interesting, just a very exotic star. Space is full of things like this. I'm sure there's even more dramatic stars we haven't even thought of or seen yet, but here's this one. And this leads to some interesting thoughts. You know, these days with computers and GPS, we need very accurate time, precise time. Well, pulsars are a possible object to use for a time standard because they are so regular with their spin rate. You know, this light that's flashing. Now, as we watch some of these over a few years, you can see them slowing down gradually. But if you know what that slowdown is, it's still a very precise time standard. What do we use today to tell, you know, microseconds and nanoseconds? You've heard of these things called atomic clocks? Well, these pulsars are just as good as that, or perhaps even better. Here's just a double picture. Over on the left-hand side is these pulsar signals. Again, these are usually radio waves that are clipping our way, and we pick them up with these big satellite antennas. And over on the right-hand side in this picture is an atomic clock where you're looking at molecules vibrating. So these are both used as good time standards, but these pulsars, were they designed for us to have accurate time? I even think of scripture where, again, it says those lights in the sky are for signs and seasons and days and years and nanoseconds, maybe. That seems to be the way this thing is going. Pulsars could be very useful for us. Just as dinosaur, that's ankylosaur was an example that design's been with us from the beginning, there's something special about this example. These things aren't alive, these pulsars. Pulsars don't mutate. They don't naturally select. They don't improve with time. You know, they've been around since the creation. And again, that kind of defeats the evolutionary explanation. It's just another good design that we have in space. Hey, we made it through our 12 examples. By the way, if you want to get more of this kind of stuff, a friend and I put a book together called Discovery of Design. I ran out of copies. I don't have any more on the desk out there, but this is available on Amazon.com. And also Answers in Genesis sells this book as well. What we did is we wrote up 100 examples of these designs from space and a picture of them and the invention that's been come up with. And we've started a website, Discovery of Design. There we have hundreds more examples. What we're trying to do is come up with a reservoir of designs that God's put in nature that have practical benefit for us, just to put a positive spin on all this. And as I think about this, I think this is a whole new way to look at science. It's a whole new paradigm, looking at nature to see the secrets that God put there for us to find and put to good use. And I think that's just kind of a good push to study all we can in science and have excellence there and even see God's handiwork on all sides. So anyway, that's Discovery of Design. Thanks for listening. Our afternoon goes on. Thank you, folks. And by the way, if anyone has more examples in this area, we're trying to collect them and email them to me or whatever. And again, we're trying to get kind of a whole reservoir of these interesting examples from nature. Yes, sir.
Jack. Have you done any work with the discovery of design in terms of music that is made, particularly by birds or whales, dolphins?
Wow, the design, sound, music. Haven't gone there. That'd be interesting. Yeah, there's some lessons or some direction there on how to make music. Yeah. That's interesting, thinking about bird song. You know, we can hear some of the sounds birds make, but they make some sounds that are way above what we can hear. I think the birds are talking about us in a way that we can't even hear. Yeah, we've got a lot to learn about that whole area of acoustics. That'd be a whole different area to look at. Yes, sir.
How do evolutionists?
They would say that design is only apparent. To say that that ankylosaur has that fancy tailbone, they would say, well, some of his ancestors didn't have that. And so the tailbone was too heavy, and so they were sluggish, so they died out. And so it's the ones that happened to get mutated that had that right kind of tail, that those are the ones that kind of took over. Now, I'm okay with, you know, selection, that things select out that have a benefit to them. But they would say that there's been a long line of improvements over time. The fossil record doesn't show that. These designs go back as far as we can see, but they would say they haven't found all the fossils yet.
In some ways, are we arguing probability? You know, once we line up all these things, their argument is an argument. By lining up all these discoveries, we show that the chance of these things happening is.
Probability arguments are firmly on the side of creation, every way you look at it, but it's not convincing to that side of the world. You know, in biology, how did life get started on planet Earth? What is the origin of life? It's the great unsolved mystery. And all our experiments, we can't even make it work in the laboratory putting the right chemicals together. So if you talk to a consistent evolutionist and say, well, look, you can't explain how life got started. Nothing works. And they'll say, they've told me, they'll say, I don't care how improbable it is. I don't care if the probability is zero. It happened, so live with it. That's their position. I mean, it's not rational, but they don't really have any other choice. So it's all on our side, but it doesn't seem to go too far. And you know what's going on here. It takes the work of the Holy Spirit to change hearts. And this is all fun stuff, but it goes beyond that. Yes, sir.
I agree with you that mathematics is an integral part of the universe rather than a set of numbers that just happen to describe. I guess the evolutionists would have a latter position, but I don't know how they would explain mathematics being an integral part of the universe.
talking about mathematics and all the patterns there, my whole career has been in physics, looking at you know, the fundamental laws of nature, whether it's gravity or relativity or whatever. And even though I read all the books, they've never been very good at explaining where these things come from. these laws of nature or the mathematics that's behind it. It's just a great vacuum. And they just have to assume that those laws are there. But those laws, they make the whole universe consistent and possible to live in. There's no good answer from the other side. And it makes, to my mind, creation so refreshing that we at least we've got somebody to do it. Yes, sir. My background, brought up in a religious family, always went to church, Sunday school, whether you were sick or not. There was some legalism there, but it was good. There was a lot of scripture memory that was has served valuable to me. But I don't think that I really knew the Lord in a personal way. There was sort of an assumption that you were born into the kingdom. Well, I was going to school up north of here at Michigan Tech, and my wife and I were both up there and kind of at the same stage. And one Sunday night, we went to a small country Baptist church. And the pastor was a prison guard who just, you know, preached on Sunday. And he took us aside and kind of showed us the excitement of the genuine Christian life and got us together with some other Christian couples. That kind of got us started. That kind of turned my grad school around, looking at this stuff in a new way. I think I was probably confused about design and the age of the earth and all that before that. So a couple things happened. That happened, and then at another church, there was a conference in town, kind of like this one. And this speaker came to town, and he challenged us to consider the idea of a recent supernatural creation. I thought, come on, this is something from the 1700s. But he said, no, think about it. And I've been thinking about it ever since with growing confidence. His name was John Whitcomb, by the way. Who's still around, one of the pioneers, and that's why I went to Grace and worked with him. He's retired now, but that's where he is in Indiana. Thanks for asking that. That was a quick testimony. A couple more questions before we quit here? Yes, sir.
How much of this stuff is knowledge that has been lost over time? When you talk about algebra, a lot of that was lost. European culture, elsewhere, and we're just rediscovering. Have you done much?
I'm sure we've lost material. And do we have to refine it again? What also comes to mind with your question, we've mentioned Isaac Newton, who was a godly man. I don't know all the details of his theology. Don't want to go there. But God has made some brilliant guys and gals in the past. And I'm not sure we even have the depth that Newton understood and knew. I think... You know, now we have large teams of people and we still make discoveries, but those people had insights that may have been lost to time. And I think science has gone off on a tangent and has marginalized itself because it's become naturalistic. It doesn't allow the creator and it doesn't give him any credit. Science makes progress, but I think that it's impoverished itself and would do a lot better if it was honoring the Lord. And that's what some of us try to do. And I'm encouraged with kids here. There's a next generation coming on who will keep on with this whole area and keep pushing it. Not that we're going to convince the whole world that the earth is young and creation is there, but they'll be that group that'll keep pushing that and giving people that that choice and that challenge. Thank you, folks.
Folks, I would...